Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I have a new little intro sound for you.
I see.
Hello and welcome to episode 193 of Geek Town Radio. This week I have with me...
Yes, right, I see.
Tell the people what disaster has befallen you this week.
I don't know what you're talking about. I definitely haven't cut the internet to the studio with some secateurs, went gardening and now can't do any live streaming.
Well done.
I did also like knee a bit of furniture with my other knee.
But that's just you being you, though, really.
Yeah, I didn't break that knee, so I've still only got the one super damaged leg. I've just got like a nice colour on the other knee now. It matches my hair.
To be fair, I could chop the soaring bit off the top of that and just use that at your intro every week, really. You know, just something falling over.
I want to deny it, but I can't because it's true. So, you know.
So apart from demolishing the internet in your studio, what else have you been doing this week?
Well, that obviously was the highlight of my week.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, that was great fun. I have been watching The Umbrella Academy, which I'm sure you have been watching as well.
Yes.
I'm trying to pace myself and not just spend a day watching the whole thing in one go.
Yeah, I'm two episodes in at the moment. My favourite description of it has been in a couple of headlines, which is, it's a superhero show via Wes Anderson, which I rather like.
It's just like, I mean, I've been excited since they announced it, obviously, because the comic book is it's not that well known mainstream, but within kind of the comic book world it's pretty well respected,
and it's a great book.
Such a nice, fresh, very realistic take on the kind of superhero genre, and it's a good kind of way of playing with the conventions of that. And I think it's pretty accessible, I think, even for people that aren't really into superheroes and comic books and stuff. The way they filmed it is pretty cool.
Yeah, I know. I've been really enjoying it. This is the show. I mean, we've talked about Umbrella Academy a lot, but it's basically these bunch of women have children all on one day, having never been pregnant at the start of the day, and suddenly they all have children. A rich, slightly mad billionaire basically picks up seven of them and forms this superhero team out of the kids. Is essentially, and this is them. The father's now died, or the mad billionaire who they refer to as their father has now died, and they're all coming back together for the funeral. And it's sort of the relationships between all the kids that are left, because some of them haven't survived to adulthood, and it's just brilliant. I'm really, really enjoying the first couple of episodes of it. I think the casting's amazing as well.
Well, it's got, what's his name? Is his surname Sheenan?
Yeah, Robert Sheenan.
I utterly adore him. He's getting very much sort of typecast into roles he enjoys playing, so he's probably fine with that. But most people know him, to start with, from Misfits, which for the first few seasons I adored, and he did steal the scene.
Totally.
Quite a lot in that. I also just generally just like think he's quite a funny person. He comes across as someone who really kind of channels that kind of energy, and he's the perfect choice for that role, and he's clearly loving it.
Yeah, no, totally. Robert Sheehan's been absolutely fabulous. I've loved him in both things. He's he popped up in Mortal Engines, actually, but he's also in Fortitude as well, is the other thing that he pops up in. But yeah, he's great. Tom Hopper, who people will know from Merlin and Game of Thrones as well. But he's great as Space Boy number one, Luther.
I mean, they're all pretty well cast because they're such a... The point is that they're this diverse, clashing group of people who don't merge well together, who've had this really dysfunctional upbringing, who don't know their place in the world, and they've cast it very well so that you can feel that awkward tension but that family bond of joint experience. Like, it's a difficult thing to get right, and so far, like, I've watched three episodes, so I'm only one ahead of you, and then I forced myself to stop and go to bed last night. It's really compelling viewing, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it pans out.
Yeah, I'm very much enjoying it. I have the same sort of thing. I'm kind of get to the end of the episode and I've kind of started watching a little bit the first, I'm like, no, I gotta go and go to bed and not sit until like 4 a.m. and just stream this stuff.
It's tempting, it's so tempting, and they're doing so well with the because I can't remember what the budget was, but they are really, really well using where to put the money for special effects where not to, and it's really well balanced because nothing sort of stands out as cheap or jarring visually. It's just working really well as grounding some quite fantastical things in a really mundane real world.
Yeah, I mean, just the casting's great. Mary J. Blige, I didn't realise, was playing one of the two assassins, which I hadn't realised. So she's in there as well. So Tom Hopper, bless him, his accent's kind of a little bit all over the place, but, you know, I think it's forgivable. The character had been on the moon for 4 years and not talking to anybody, so maybe his accent changed slightly. But
maybe he was watching a lot of TV
British
from other
TV,
places.
Yes.
I think you can kind of work that in with how kind of broken they all are.
Yeah. Ellen Page as well, playing Vanya, who's the one kid out of the group who apparently has no supernatural abilities, so she plays that dejected character really well. Sure, so massive shout out to Aidan Gallagher, who plays the number five, the kid. He's phenomenal, playing a boy who is, or rather a 57-year-old man, or what, however old he is, that's inhabiting a 13-year-old boy's body, and he's brilliant at it. I mean, I thought that was just superb.
He is snarky and charismatic to the max.
He's brilliant.
Some of the things, I don't want to give away any spoilers and things about his character, but some of the things he's doing and his commitment to playing some things that could come across as a bit kooky or silly and playing them straight and believable, like rescuing his companion, that's something that's quite hard to do. So props to him. He's got wisdom kind of beyond his age to pull that off believably, because you do believe it. So that's I'm assuming that he's going to get more and more challenging roles after this.
I really hope so, because I mean, I thought he was absolutely fabulous. So yeah, the great all round. Go and watch it. It's absolutely brilliant. Really one of the best superhero dramas they've come out with on Netflix in a while. It's a very solid start for them. So developed by a guy called Steve Blackman, apparently, for TV. I don't know what else he's done. Oh, second season of Fargo he was involved with. Oh, and Altered Carbon as well.
Oh, so, that makes sense.
And he's done various other things, but those are the two that stick out to me. What else have you been doing?
I saw Battle Angel Alita.
Okay.
Alita Battle Angel, as it has to be called because of Cameron, because he wants to keep all his things beginning with A's and so forth.
This is going to be interesting. We have got an interview with somebody from Alita Battle Angel coming up. So, yes, what did you think?
On some levels, I really liked it.
Yes.
I can see why in some places that there are some amazing homages to bits in the anime and in the manga. So there are some fight scenes where it's like they've taken pages from the comic book and used it for the storyboard.
Right.
So it was quite brilliant to see some of those things brought to life and realized in a very, very entertaining way. Other than that, I felt that they very much wanted a particular age rating on their movie, and they've pulled their punches in some places, because the story is, it's quite brutal. And I don't mean that just in a violent sense. I'm not just complaining because there isn't enough blood or something like that. It is quite brutal. They just swap the cyborg blood to blue to make it easier to get some of that in. But
fair enough.
There are some places where it feels they've smoothed off the edges a bit, and they've shied back from some things, and they've packed extra things in to avoid some of the darker aspects.
Right.
And it's a difficult one to describe. I definitely think they put too much in, though, by merging the primary spine of the plotline of the first arc, which is the first two comic books, also was the main focus of the anime, but then adding in some of the stuff that was additional in the anime, like extra characters, but then mashing in some stuff from the next couple of comic books as well, because they really obviously wanted to have the Motorball.
Right.
And that stuff is all supposed to happen way later. Throwing herself into Motorball is what she does because of the end of the first arc, which I won't spoil for anyone that's not seen it. So it's, and there's the bit with the heart. Some of the bits with the romance I felt were so cheesy.
Yeah, I mean, that seems fair.
But it was enjoyable, and you can see that they really loved the source material when they made this.
Yeah.
That comes through.
I haven't seen the movie yet. I've only seen the trailers for it, and it looks, the look of it is fairly spectacular.
Oh, it looks gorgeous. Yeah, the visual effects are beautiful, and the effort they've put into the world building and creating, well, it's called Iron City now, but it's originally called the Scrapyard. It's stunning. It really, really is. The special effects and the mix they've done of the computer-based effects and physical effects and stuff is merged gorgeously. Right. I mean, it's what you expect. It's Cameron.
Yeah, he's
kind of, that was his vision for it, even if he didn't end up directing it. His influence is very strong there.
It's directed by Robert Rodriguez, isn't it? So
yeah, he passed it over because he didn't have the time to put into it, and Rodriguez is obviously another comic book fan. He did Sin City, and he's a well-known fan of these kind of these kind of things, so he also loves the comic book, so it's helmed by multiple people that love the source material.
As I say, I've not seen it. The interview that's coming up later, we spoke with Kayla Edelblum, who is one of the two production designers on it, so she talks about sort of building the sets, and they're actually working on an interactive experience for it as well, which is going out to various cities across the US. That will be coming up a bit later. I'll talk about that a bit later. So I'm glad it all looks good, given that we're talking to her.
It does. I think there was no doubt that it was going to look beautiful. And for everyone complaining about the eyes, they do explain the eyes in the movie.
Right. Okay. Good.
Because that's been a big criticism. People saying there's no reason for her to have eyes like that. But it actually, there is plenty of reason, and it works very well. And they do explain it, and it is important. That's all I'm going to say, is that don't let the kind of uncanny valley-ness put
right,
you off,
because
it is intentional.
Okay, cool. That's good. Anything
what else?
What else
have I done? I've played quite a lot of D&D in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, good.
So there's been quite a lot of being a tabaxi dragon sorcerer, which is basically a cat person.
Yes, of course.
Dragon
of course
sorcerer. I'm a purple cat person that can breathe lightning, because why would you be anything else?
Why would you be anything else? Yes.
Yeah, well, I've been playing out some other games with a different character who's kind of a noble half elven lady with a ginormous axe that, if she can't negotiate with people, chops their heads off.
Fair enough. Yes.
That's been quite fun. It's a good, enjoyable experience. I'm glad I've kind of got back into it, and it's becoming such a big scene again.
No, it is. It's really taken off D&D, and it's great fun as well. I haven't played for many, many years, but I used to love playing D&D, and I need to find a local group or something.
It's good, and I especially like groups that don't take themselves too seriously.
Oh, yeah.
And it's as much the socialising and having a laugh and coming up with very silly things to do as it is kind of playing the game. We're not too fussed about sort of levelling up and stats and things, and it's more about having a laugh. And it's good to see something like that kind of making a big comeback, because it's a great way to meet people and blow things up with lightning.
Yeah, totally. Anything else?
I've been watching and enjoying and learning a lot about Twitch in preparation for when I sticky tape my internet cable back together and get back on there. I've been trying to figure out how to hook up my actual childhood retro consoles so I can possibly stream those.
Ah, cool.
There'll be an interesting mix of really, really retro and VR, because apparently I like extremes.
Yes.
Although some of my VR is retro, because I've got things like Serious Sam in VR. So.
Oh, cool.
It all makes sense. Yeah, a lot of the fellow streamers I know are streaming at the moment for Game Blast 19.
Okay.
Which is a week-long charity streaming event for special effects. Special effects, a lot of us will know, if you go to any of the games events or Comic Cons, they build custom controllers for people, especially children who have disabilities and need special controllers so they can enjoy the world of gaming. So there's going to be a week of laughing at / with a lot of my friends on Twitch and telling them to set fire to things, because that's become a thing.
Yes, that should be good. I'm assuming your Twitch channel is Trista Bytes as well, with a Y.
It is. It currently just has a picture that says everything's broken, but but it will. It will. As soon as I've sticky taped that cable back together, I will be Twitch streaming because it's great fun.
I have a Twitch channel. I never really use it, and I really should get back into it. I've done a couple of bits on Subnautica and stuff, but I should get back into it at some point.
I'd love to get a 360 camera or something and just walk around the cons and just live stream.
Yeah, that'd be good. Trouble is, the only thing I'm really playing at the moment is Civilization 6 because the new expansion came out, and I can't imagine that's particularly interesting for streaming. So
You never know. Some of these things are very therapeutic to watch, or you could just set fire to everything. Whichever. Yes. Yeah. One or the other.
I had heard that become a thing. You bunch of retro gamers are apparently pyromaniacs as well.
I totally haven't made 3 or 4 streamers set fire to things, including destroying the end of someone's Red Dead Redemption game.
Oh my God.
I had him burn down all the post offices so he couldn't pay off his bounty. It was fine. But no one's obligated to listen to me.
No.
And it was hysterical. There was much laughing going on that stream. And I'm assuming he can go back to a save point before
I would hope so, yes.
Before the entire chat started telling him to set fire to everything. Oh. We sort of crossed Red Dead Redemption with other games at that point, I think.
Yes.
We sort of tried to turn it into Halo/GTA.
Oh dear. Well, for me this week, along with the Umbrella Academy, the Expanse Season 3, which came out last week, I finished that.
How did I not know that was that? I need to just get off this podcast and watch that now. I will be binge watching that and the Umbrella Academy, and I will return back to the world afterwards.
Right, yes. The Expanse Season 3, which of course is now on Amazon, not Netflix, because of Amazon taking over the franchise. And Season 4 is coming later in the year as well, they have said. They have confirmed that he's definitely coming later in the year. So
not non-spoilery, is Season 3 good?
Yes, non-spoilery. Season 3 is good. I think it pares down the number of plot lines from Season 2, so it makes it a little bit easier to follow, because Season 2 had like 5 different interlocking plot lines that were sort of weaving in and out of each other all the time, which was great, but it took a lot of concentrations at points. Season 3 has less plot lines to follow, and they do kind of intersect much better, I think. So it makes it a little bit easier to follow. Still one of the best sci-fis out there. It's still really, really enjoyable. So I'm thoroughly loving that series. I can't wait for Season 4. I don't want to spoil it for anybody that hasn't watched it yet, but go and watch The Expanse. It's absolutely brilliant. Another show which I've been watching recently, which is on the sort of fantasy sci-fi edge, is The Passage, which I started watching a few weeks ago and keep on forgetting to mention it. This is the Mark Paul Gosselaar fronted show, which is about, it's based on a book actually, I think, or a book series. It's about a guy who is sort of ex-special ops. He's working for this secret government project, which is supposed to be to cure all diseases, the idea, and they inadvertently basically create vampires, or a sort of vampire zombie-ish kind of hybrid thing. They think that these people that they have, or these vampires that they have under lock and key, they're sort of keeping them and examining them and trying to figure out, you know, what's causing the process to kind of turn them into this, and they figure out that if they expose a young child to it, it could possibly mean that they get all the benefits without being turned into the sort of zombie-ish state that they end up being in. So that's basically what they do. They send the Spec Ops team out to find a kid that nobody will miss. Mark Paul Gosselaar's character comes across this little girl, and they take her from a like group home, and he becomes very uneasy when he starts to figure out that something quite bad could happen to her, and ends up sort of absconding with her. And that's the sort of basic setup for it. It's a really good series. I've very much been enjoying it. Mark Paul Gosselaar, of course, most people will know from, well, he was Franklin and Bash was the thing he's done more recently, but prior to that, Zach from Saved by the Bell, which he's never going to escape. Poor lad. But he's great in this, and it's a full-on sort of action thing for him, but really, really enjoying that. If you've not watched The Passage, go and check that out. It's on Fox. And The Walking Dead Robot Chicken special as well arrived on E4 this week.
Because why not?
just hilarious. It's a little bit old now, so it runs up to about sort of just after sort of Negan started appearing in the series. So it sort of was done, I think, last year sometime or the year before. It's just half an hour of silliness with the robot chicken guys poking fun at Walking Dead and doing a sort of run through the history, and it starts off in a museum, which is sort of after the zombie apocalypse and everything's kind of gone back to normal, and they're a museum of them wandering around, the saviors from the Walking Dead, and they've got all these made up stories about Rick and the group and what happened to them and this sort of stuff. And then old Carl turns up and says, no, this isn't how it happened, and starts telling them the story and of the sort of history, except that's not exactly how it happened either. So it's just brilliant. And if they've got all the guys from Walking Dead, or a whole bunch of the guys from the Walking Dead, to come in and do the voices for it as well. So that's well worth going to watch. There's a load of Robot Chicken stuff and a load of Adult Swim stuff, which is now on a specific Adult Swim channel on All4, which you can go on and get. So if you're a fan of like those sort of anarchic animated series from Adult Swim, they're all up on All4 now, or quite a lot of them are. So the first batch of them went live on the 15th, so you can go and check those out as well. There's a whole lot that are on streaming, and they are putting some of them on E4 as well.
I might check that out, even though I don't like Walking Dead, because I think it will still be funny.
Yeah, well, if you don't want to watch the Walking Dead one, there's the Walking Dead one, there are the DC special ones, which are equally hilarious, there are the Star Wars ones, which are brilliant. And there's the main Robot Chicken series as well, which I think, I'm not sure whether season 9 is on there, but they're definitely airing season 9 on E4 as well. But I think it may already be up on the All4 channel. Certainly the previous seasons of Robot Chicken is up there. If you've never seen Robot Chicken, stop motion animation, and it's very, very, very funny. So that's all the stuff we've been doing for this week. Let's move on to some TV and film news. Start off the TV and film news this week with renewals, cancellations and pickups. First cancellation I was a bit sorry about, because Counterpart has been cancelled after 2 seasons. And I know this isn't a show which a lot of people in the UK probably haven't seen, because it's on Starzplay, which is an add-on channel for Amazon. So it's not like there's a huge amount of people that have probably signed up to this. But it's got a great cast, and it's such a shame that they've decided not to pick it up for a 3rd season. But I think they're shopping it round, but we'll have to wait and see. That never usually ends well, but we'll wait and see whether anybody picks it up. Also, Into the Badlands has been cancelled by AMC after 3 seasons. We're just waiting for the second half of season 3 to come back, which is the 25th of April. That's apparently returning, but that will be the end of it. So it's not really a show. I think I watched an episode or two of it, but it's not really a show I massively got into, but I know there was a lot of people very upset about that. Amazon have renewed Jack Ryan for a 3rd season, even though the 2nd season isn't out yet. So definitely going to get more Jack Ryan, which is no bad thing, because I think they did a great job in the 1st season of that. The Goldbergs spin-off Schooled has apparently been picked up by E4, as far as we can tell. They've not really publicised that, but there are, other than putting trailers on TV and it's randomly popped up, they've not given any press information, but it appears to be on there. And then a few advanced air dates for you. Santa Clarita Diet Season 3, that is returning on the 29th of March. Hannah, which is this coming-of-age assassin thriller with a little kid, that is arriving on the 29th of March on Amazon as well. And Good Omens is going to be premiering on the 31st of May. And Benedict Cumberbatch has been the last person really to be added to the cast, and he's going to be playing Satan, or voicing Satan rather, because it's going to be an animated character apparently.
I know a lot of people that are looking forward to that series coming out.
The casting on Good Omens is just phenomenal. It's basically a who's who of kind of British and American top talent. It's just incredible. Yes, I think Frances McDormand is playing God as well. She's voicing God, and Benedict Cumberbatch is voicing Satan. So yes, that's definitely one to look out for. 31st of May for that on Amazon. It will then come onto the BBC at some point later on, but we don't know exactly when. It will be exclusive on Amazon for a bit and then go onto the BBC because they co-funded it. Breaking Bad, there is a movie coming from that starring Aaron Paul, and it seems like it's going to be premiering on Netflix and then going on to AMC, despite AMC being the people that originally aired Breaking Bad in the US. It seems because Netflix were the people that sort of kept it alive, they've kind of won the bid to get the movie first, and then AMC will have it second. And I added this one in today because I thought you may have seen this news already, but the Loki series, which is going to have some involvement from the love of your life, Tom Hiddleston.
yeah, I sometimes let him out to work. back.
So they've announced a little bit more news about it. It's going to follow Loki as the trickster and shapeshifter pops up throughout human history as an unlikely influencer in historical events. That's the idea of it. So there were stories about it maybe going to be sort of not that much involvement of Hiddleston and being more of a young Loki series. I think the young Loki angle is probably going to be in there, but it seems like Hiddleston's going to be in there as well. So it's going to be kind of a mixture of the two by the sounds of it, but he is definitely going to be in it. They've also announced that the showrunner for it and writer of the pilot episode is going to be a guy called Michael Waldron. Interesting previous credits. Rick and Morty, he was a production assistant. Community, he was a writer's production assistant. He then did a show called Harmon Quest, which is a sort of animated series seemingly about Dan Harmon, who is one of the creators of Rick and Morty, playing D&D with his friends. And Good Game, which he was producer on, which was a series about esports. So it's a very interesting eclectic mix of stuff to then suddenly become showrunner on something as big as Loki. That's the guy that's running it. But I think something like Rick and Morty is an interesting touch point for something which is a guy jumping through history into different events and stuff.
Yeah, and that kind of dark, dry comedy. Yeah. As well. I think I don't know when, obviously I'm aware of Rick and Morty and things, but I don't know the rest of them. I've watched some of Community. I haven't watched enough of Community. I've had that told to me a lot. So I can see where they're going with that. My main obvious interest is the percentage of screen time for Tom Hiddleston, but I think it's brilliant that they're looking at making series of things like this and starting with Loki. I mean, they know they have to get it right or there'll be massive uproar, so I would assume it's going to be good.
The difference with this as well is it seems to be attached directly to the movie universe, unlike the Marvel TV universe, which is sort of tangentially attached, but is sort of run by a different division in Marvel, whereas this seemingly is being run by the movie division of it. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But
they've picked a main kind of spine for the storyline, which doesn't have any effect on anything happening in the movie. So it gives them a lot of freedom as well, which I think is a brilliant move.
Yeah, so they can announce this without it spoiling what happens to Loki in Endgame, because Loki's supposed to be fine. Yes. Did you keep wishing that? he is supposed to be popping up in Endgame, but in what capacity, we don't know. Whether it's flashback or dream sequence or some other way, we don't know. So we'll see. I would like to think Loki's fine as well, because I love Loki. He's a great character.
Yeah, I think he evolved the most out of all of the characters, because they didn't originally intend for him to be a large part of the... I think it was the second Thor movie. They didn't intend for him to be a large part at all, and because of the fan response, they rewrote a lot of the plots for movies going on, and they put a lot more of Loki into those movies. So I think they know how beloved their character is, and hopefully they will treat him accordingly.
Yes.
And just make many more things. Just they need to make a Loki movie. People would watch it.
Oh, totally. Yes. So we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, that, of course, is coming to Disney Plus. We don't know how that stuff will be handled outside of the US yet. I believe they are going to launch Disney Plus internationally, but it's sort of all a bit up in the air. It's not launching in America till the end of next year, or the end of this year, sorry. And then it will launch worldwide, they've said, sometime after that, but we don't know exactly what they're going to do with it and how soon and all that sort of thing. So we'll see where that goes. Sticking with Marvel, they've also announced that they've got four new adult animated series which are coming to Hulu in the US. Whilst The Defenders might be gone, The Offenders are now coming in animated form. There's actually five new series. There's sort of four series, and much like The Defenders, there's basically four series and then a sort of team-up series coming. So it's going to be Marvel's MODOK, Marvel's Hit Monkey, Marvel's Tigra and Dazzler Show, and Marvel's Howard the Duck as an animated series. And then there's going to be Marvel's The Offenders, which is the team-up show as well. So do you know any of these characters? Obviously Howard the Duck, but...
Yeah, everyone knows Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
Some of the other ones I know, but not incredibly well. But I'm just happy that we're getting some of these properties made, and I think animated is the best format for them, because it's the only way you're going to get away with a lot of the content.
Yeah.
And it would require stupid budgets anyway to make them any other way. So I'm quite pleased by this, and I'm looking forward to seeing how ridiculous some of these are going to be. I think entertaining is what they're going to go for with this one.
Yes, yeah. They've got some interesting people involved with it as well. The Howard the Duck series is actually going to come from filmmaker, podcaster and comic book writer Kevin Smith, whose work I
who
love.
Who probably like fought other people off to get that job.
Yeah, so it's him and Aqua Teen Hunger Force's Dave Willis are the two people involved in that. So that, I think, has a really, really solid team behind it. I mean, Howard the Duck has been a film once made by Ron Howard, and he did pop up in the end credits of, was it Guardians 2? I think it was or Guardians 1, the end credit of that. So I'm very much looking forward to that. It should be brilliant. MODOK is an egomaniacal supervillain with a really big head and a really little body who struggles to maintain control of his ego organization and demanding family. The series comes from Jordan Bloom, who is one of the American Dad writers, and Patton Oswalt, who is a brilliant comedian, if you've never heard of him, and he's also an actor and a writer. So they're the people involved with that. That one sounds good. I think he's voicing MODOK as well. Marvel's Hit Monkey tells the tale of a wrong Japanese snow monkey mentored by the ghost of an American assassin as he cuts a wide sway through Tokyo's underworld in this darkly cinematic and brutally funny revenge saga. That's coming from Josh Gordon, Will Speck. Tiger and Dazzler sees two woke superheroes and best friends. Tiger and Dazzler fight for recognition amongst the powered people that make up the 8 million stories in Los Angeles. So that's Erica Rivenoja and Chelsea Handler, the two people behind that. And then Marvel's The Offenders is the team-up series which will bring them all together. They haven't announced the writers for that, but Jeff Loeb, as with all the series, is serving as exec producer. If you're wondering why they're on Hulu and not Disney Plus, the reason that they're on Hulu is because Disney owns a large stake in Hulu now, particularly with the Fox acquisition, and Disney Plus is being kept as a sort of PG-13, 12 rated platform. So that's
These will not be.
Yes, which these most definitely won't be. That's the same reason why all the Defenders characters, the Marvel Netflix show characters, aren't going to end up on Disney Plus when Netflix got rid of them. They've double confirmed today that Marvel had no say in the cancellation, so it was most definitely Netflix that dropped them. Hulu have actually said that they would be interested, you know, they're open to the possibility of taking on some of those shows. Whether it will actually happen, I don't know. Of course, we don't have Hulu in the UK, so who knows where they might end up. You might end up going across onto Amazon. Maybe they get picked up by normal channels. We don't know. Hopefully they'll pop up somewhere.
Amazon picked up The Tick, which is another very spoofy, grown-up, ridiculous superhero thing. And that was an Amazon original, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was.
As well. So if they have a say, they might want at least, you know, something like Howard the Duck that is the most well-known of that set. I think that it would be cool if we could get them over here because it would be a shame to miss out on them.
Yeah, I mean, E4 and Channel 4 have picked up a number of Hulu shows, and Amazon have picked up a number of Hulu shows. So I think those are the two most likely spots you're going to get them, I would have thought. Sci-fi maybe as well is a possibility. They've picked up some Hulu series like Runaways if they're genre series, so Sci-Fi UK could possibly take them as well, but we'll have to wait and see whether they pop up somewhere over here.
Yeah, makes me miss the old days of MTV when MTV used to air all the insane cartoons.
Yeah.
Because that would have been where that ended up otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that makes me think Channel 4 might not pick them up is because they've just done this big deal with Adult Swim, which gives them a whole bunch of animated content. So that might put them off. But I think it would be quite an attractive proposition to somebody like Amazon. So we'll have to see. Sticking with comic book stuff and Netflix, one of the reasons that they sort of walked away from the Marvel thing, apart from the fact that Disney are going to be a rival service to them. The other thing was that they bought Mark Miller's Miller World and were starting to adapt some of Mark Miller's stuff into their own shows. And one of those was a comic book called Jupiter's Legacy, which is a multi-generational American superhero epic, which follows the world's first generation of superheroes who received their powers in the 1930s. And in the present day, they're the revered Elder Guard, but the superpowered children struggled to live up to the legendary feats of their parents. So it's quite an interesting sort of setup, I think, for that. They've announced some casting for it. The show comes from Stephen S. DeKnight, who you all know from shows like Daredevil. He was involved with Spartacus, and he was one of the Buffy writers as well. So he comes out of that Joss Whedon stable. The casting's actually really good for this. Justin Elm, who you will know probably from the Transformers movies more than anything else, he's playing the Utopian, Sheldon Sampson, who is sort of the leader of the group. Ben Daniels, who you know from The Crown, I think he was in Rogue One as well, and The Exorcist. He plays Walter Sampson Brainwave, Sheldon's elder brother. Leslie Bibb, who was in Tag and Iron Man, she takes Grace Sampson, Lady Liberty. Eleanor Campouris, who was in Sacred Lies, and Andrew Horton, who was in Doctors and How to Talk to Girls at Parties, play Sheldon and Grace, the children of Chloe and Brandon. Mike Wade, who was in Timeless and For the People, plays Fitz Small. And Matt Lanter, who was in Timeless, played one of the main characters in Timeless. He will star as George Hutchinson, who is also known as Sky Fox, apparently, as well, and is one of the close friends of the main family. So I think the casting's really strong with this. Do you know the comic book particularly?
This one, I haven't actually read this one. I should have. It's exactly in my wheelhouse. It's something that I very much should have read. But Miller is an epic and exceedingly well-renowned writer. Mm. And if the adaptations of other things that are going on that are all kind of... There's a massive trend at the moment for your realistic, dark, superhero-y type stuff going on. So I've got high hopes for it. I promptly need to go out and buy this and read it, I think.
So I'm sure I bought a copy of it. Maybe I haven't read it yet. I don't know, but because I don't remember. But so it's based on his comic book. Netflix now own Millerworld, which they bought in 2017. They're actually making a bunch of the different things, either as series or movies. They've got American Jesus, which is another one of Miller's things, Empress, Hook, and Sharky the Bounty Hunter as well as the other one they're making. So they're all going to be made into either series or movies. They haven't specified one way or the other. So yeah, I'm rather looking forward to this. I think this could be really good. I mean, because you've got this coming here, you've got The Boys coming on Amazon, which I'm very much looking forward to because that's a great book as well.
Yeah, I love that comic.
Yeah, so this is sort of more dealing with the family stuff, whereas, you know, The Boys is kind of, is subverting entirely the sort of superhero genre, where the Boys is based around a group which are there to keep the superheroes in check because the superheroes basically are all dicks. So in The Boys, they've all let the power get to their heads and they're all like rock star sort of superheroes and they really don't care about collateral damage and this sort of thing. So the Boys are brought in to basically keep them in check. That is coming later in the year and I'm very, very much looking forward to that one coming to Amazon. So this is another great one though. I think casting's really interesting and Justin Elm's great, Ben Daniels is great. So yes, it's an interesting selection of people. And Matt Lanter is fabulous in Timeless. It just means we're definitely not getting any more Timeless. And the last story we got this week, USA Network has ordered Aldous Huxley's Brave New World straight to series. You may remember years ago we talked about this on the podcast because this has been floating around since about 2016. It was originally pitched, I think, at Sci-Fi, and USA Network have now picked it up, who were kind of, they're part of, all part of NBC. So it's sort of one of their sister stations, and given it a straight-to-series order. For those that don't know Brave New World, it's a classic novel set in this seemingly utopian futuristic society. Whilst there's peace and stability, the people are drugged to stay happy, so they have a number of their freedoms removed, such as prohibition to monogamy, privacy, money, family, and history itself. Children are created and conditioned to play specific roles in society where they're split into castes. So if you're born as a factory worker, you're conditioned to like living in cities and not have any interest in books and just be kept in your place. So the story centres around two citizens of New London, Bernard Marks and Lenita Crown. They've only ever known the rigid social order, a perfect pharmaceutical called Soma, and the culture of instant gratification and ubiquitous sex. Curious to explore life beyond their strict society, the two New Worlders embark on a vacation to the savage lands where they become embroiled in a harrowing and violent rebellion. Bernard and Lenita are rescued by John the Savage, who escapes with them back to London. John's arrival in the New World soon threatens to disrupt utopian harmony, leaving them to grapple with the repercussions. The three become entwined in a fraught relationship that are awakens them to the dangers of their own conditioning. I love the sound of this. I mean, it's a great place to start. I mean, Brave New World is kind of a seminal novel anyway. So I think that's a great starting point. They've been like various adaptations of this before as TV movies. I don't think they've ever done a series of it, but it's got that sort of Handmaid's Tale vibe to it, where it's sort of this slightly alt future. And I can see why USO Network would be very tempted to pick something like this up.
Yeah, well, it's such an incredible world. And what Huxley did, I mean, it was like 31 it came out. Mm. It's such an influential work. And it's going to be interesting to see how they create something now without it appearing derivative, because so many things have taken so many cues from his work that new audiences might look at it and think it's something, oh, I've seen this before, not realizing it's actually the originator of so many ideas.
That, yeah, yeah.
Like as a dystopian future novel, it's, like you said, it's seminal. It's so massively influential. Mm. And I can't wait to see how this turns out, because it's an incredible book. And having a serialized version of it, I think, is going to be probably the best way to tell the story. And yeah, I think you're right. I don't think they have had a series made of it before. I think it's just been films. And I think that putting something like this in a film forces you to follow a certain trajectory. Yeah. In the way the story has to go, and this will probably allow it to be a lot more true to the book. I'm interested to see if they're going to update it in some ways, because The Handmaid's Tale was obviously, it was in some ways very true to the book, but it was also quite updated so that it continued to be set sort of contemporary or alternate world contemporary. So it'll be interesting to see how they're going to update it, or if they're going to leave it sort of feeling slightly jarring as a vision of what was considered the future in the 30s.
I suspect they'll update it, I would have thought, but we'll have to wait and see. I mean, the adaptation's got some interesting people behind it. David Weiner, who was a writer on Homecoming, The Killing, Flesh and Bone, and the, you'll like this, is the comic book duo of Grant Morrison and Brian Taylor, the people that were behind the TV version of Happy. And, I mean, Grant wrote the comic book as well. And Grant Morrison's a comic book legend. So, I mean, that's an interesting selection of people to be writing it, I think.
That's an amazing selection of people to be writing it. I want this to exist right now.
Yeah. I mean, certainly the weirder stuff. I mean, Morrison's known for kind of his stranger kind of writing. So that's going to be interesting to see how he handles something like this. But very much looking forward to that. They're exec producing along with a couple of the guys that were behind The Americans and are, well, they're the co-presidents of Amblin Television, who are the people that are making it. Wien is also going to serve as showrunner, and Owen Harris, who was responsible for Black Mirror San Gipino, he's going to be directing the first episode as well. And that was a great Black Mirror episode as well. I think this sounds like it could be a really, really interesting series. So that's all the news we have for this week. Next up, we have the interview.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As I mentioned earlier, the interview this week is with Kayla Edelblum, who is one of the co-production designers on Alita Battle Angel. And as Bex was saying earlier, Alita Battle Angel follows a girl called Alita, played by Rosa Salazar, who awakens with no memory of who she is in a future world that she does not recognise. And she's taken in by Ido, who is played by Christoph Waltz, a compassionate doctor who realises that somewhere in the abandoned cyborg shell is the heart of a young woman with an extraordinary past. She learns to navigate her new life in the treacherous streets of Iron City. Ido tries to shield her from her mysterious history, while her street smart new friend Hugo, played by Keenan Johnson, offers instead to help trigger her memories. That's the sort of basic setup for it. Kayla had the job of creating all the sets, and surprisingly, although it is very CGI heavy, there a lot of the stuff was physically built, and large sections of it were physically built. She's co-production designer with Steve Joyner, who she's worked on a number of projects before. She's worked with Robert Rodriguez on numerous things. She's done Dust Till Dawn. She did the Sin City movies. She did Predators. She's worked with Quentin Tarantino quite a lot on things like the Kill Bill movies and Jackie Brown. She did the movie Spy Kids as well. So we talked to her about creating sets for something like this, for a big CGI project like this, and how she went about that. We also talk about the interactive experience versions, which she was in the midst of doing when we actually called her. So we talk a bit about these interactive experience things that they are also making, which are going to be going to cities around America. Hopefully they may travel as well, but at the moment they're only going to cities in America. Here's the interview with Kayla Edelblum. We will see you afterwards with some highlights for next week on TV. Hey, is that Kayla?
David, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good, good, sir, good.
So you're out traveling again now?
I just landed in Austin again yesterday. I'm over here at Troublemaker Studios at this very moment trying to wrap up a bunch of paperwork, the most exciting thing in the world.
So you're filming, you're working on something out there at the moment.
Both Steve and I, we work as a team together, Steve Joyner.
Yeah.
And we just spent the past 5 months, of course, working on the Alita immersive experience.
Ah.
So we built these immersive experiences in New York, Los Angeles, and Austin, Texas.
Wow.
And they just each opened up the last week of January. So everything's really been building to, I know Alita has released over there, but is going to release here in a few days. So that was quite an endeavor. We had numerous set pieces that we wanted to create, and everything that we created, you know, we had to build times three to you know, be able to send, ship, transport, and, you know, send all these elements to Brooklyn, to Los Angeles. And of course, we had a huge stage space here in Austin that we were able to build.
Wow.
And these are all 7,000 to 10,000 square foot environment. So
wow,
it's quite an extensive environment. We tried to rebuild Iron City in all of them. And you can go in and there's all these games that you can play. It makes you work as a team. You meet total strangers and you team up and you try to solve all these puzzles and games. And people seem to have fun. And so that's pretty inspiring for us, of course.
That's amazing. Do you know if that's likely to travel abroad or is it just going to be in those three locations?
But based on the way I feel right now, I hope it's just those three. I think it will probably be those three. I think they plan, the company is called IM 8-Bit. That's
right.
The producing entity that was able to wrangle all these teams together to make this happen. You know, the game designer, Eric Meyer.
Right.
TelArt, who did all the like integration to get all the systems up and running. But I think the plan is for the games to run about 3 months. And, you know, here in Austin, that will carry the game through South by Southwest, which I'm sure you know
right,
is
the
dig here in March. So where everybody runs amok.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Be interesting to see if it does move anywhere else. Maybe after you've done those three, so you're not having to recreate things again. Maybe
you can move it never around. Never know. You know, I had the chance to watch several playtesting sessions.
Yeah.
When you actually see your work become integrated in a real active, dynamic activity, I have to tell you, I was really excited about taking on that challenge because it's different than working in a movie. The parameters are different. You have to be nimble in a different way. You really have to think about your architecture and be just logistically on it with every detail. And to have all the parts actually work is, you know, nobody's more amazed than me.
It must be interesting working on something like that. Whereas, you know, I'm guessing you might be building things for the interactive experience that are CGI elements in the movie, possibly as well.
The interesting thing is when you have the opportunity to work with different teams that you haven't necessarily worked with before, for us that had to do with thinking about actual game design. What are those pieces? What are those beats? How do you create set vignettes, which is basically what we originally were tasked asked to do. We built, you know, I'm sure you've seen the Kansas Bar. Mm. We built the original Kansas Bar for the movie, yeah, Alita, and it's still standing here at Troublemaker Studios. And, you know, a couple of hundred yards from it right now as we speak.
Wow.
But we had to replicate that in a scale for each location, but have all the parts be maneuverable and, you know, break down into segments so that we could ship and just fit pieces through a doorway and all those kinds of things. It was quite an endeavor because you think about people, and if you have 200 or 300 people a night going through a game, you need to address that a little differently than when you're working even on a movie. We work very, very hard, especially in our fabrication and set dressing shop, to make sure everything is completely robust, completely bombproof. But the immersive experience took that to a completely different level. We had to think about every element just being handled by people hour after hour, day after day, week after week. So that is a lot of what design is it can't just look cool. It has to work on the day.
Yeah, totally. It's fascinating to get thrown into after you've been working on the film for so long as well, I guess. So
it was definitely interesting. You know, we started on Alita Battle Angel in October of 2015. That was, I think my first email was October 23rd of that year.
Right.
And then to have this as a bookend, basically 5 to 6 months before the movie came out, to be presented with this like opportunity, it really charged us up. And I looked at my Instagram and I was amazed at how, you know, Instagram blew up with the Alita experience. People seemed to enjoy it. We built all kinds of interactive props that as a game player that you can put on and take your selfie as though you're a cyborg. So just all those little touches we wanted to really bring to life.
Yeah. For the film itself, you've worked with Robert Rodriguez, who is the director. You've worked with him on a few projects before. But I mean, this is something else entirely, because I mean, it's got the sort of, it's this huge James Cameron thing as well.
Right.
And
how
completely kind of freaked out were you when you get that first email of we want to do this, and it's going to be kind of, you know, a lot of CGI work
all this sort of stuff. You receive that first ping of an email, try to keep your stomach where it lives and not have come up in your throat. But I have to say, I remember Steve and I worked on Kill Bill. And I remember one of the very first days that we started in pre-production on Kill Bill, we were showing Quentin a prop for David Carradine. And Quentin said something to the effect of, if I had to think about every decision right now, I would quit today. And that taught me really to have a steady attitude, tackle one challenge at a time. Because the only time you get overwhelmed is when you feel like you have a cascading system of elements, you know, coming at you, which we all do, especially after production meeting, for instance. But Alita Battle Angel was quite an extraordinary team effort. It definitely brought Lightstorm Entertainment together and Robert's Troublemaker Studios, and it required every single person to make Alita succeed. Our actual building time that we had from day one of beginning construction on Iron City, for instance, that was only 4 months from the first bolt that went in the ground to shooting day. So to be able to succeed in that takes an extraordinary amount of prep, and that's where the value really is. And if you can get that, your chances of success are so much greater.
What sort of division is there between the amount of physical set compared to sort of green screen and stuff that, I mean, obviously there's extensions and stuff that are going to be done with CGI, but how much is there actually there for them to work with?
That's a great question. You know, Steve and I have worked with Robert on many green screen heavy movies, both Sin Cities and a number of others. Alita Battle Angel was absolutely practical, and the mandate was shoot as much practically as we could. Wow. Now, I remember very early on, there was talk of like going to Panama City for a week to shoot exteriors and just, you know, all manner of random thoughts crossed the table. Steve and I were pretty set and pretty clear. We felt that we could build Iron City at Troublemaker Studios. We have an expansive space right here where we've built big sets before. It's a great resource. That way we could control the look, absolutely. We wouldn't have to go back and rebuild environments or go to different locations if there was an actor availability question or, right, you know, all those things that come up. Again, you're not thinking only about design, but about the integration of location, logistics, shooting schedule. How do you block your sequences together on a shooting day? Working with your first AD is so critical. And we have a great first AD, Brian Betwave, we worked with for many, many years also. He's been with Robert. But what was really wonderful was, you know, finally saw the movie in its entirety the other night, was we created Iron City, and that was a 62,000 square foot set. Wow. So that's the footprint. It was massive. And we created all the streets so they could play double duty, so they could redress. The set dressers could come in and do an overnight redress. Dennis Street could play as a different, completely different section of the city. But I noticed in watching the movie that Weta was able to take a lot of the elements that we actually built and sort of replicate them in layers in the background matte painting sections.
Right.
Kind of tweak them, you know, maybe adjust the color, adjust the scale. But those elements, they were able to take and repeat, and it created a cohesiveness from the foreground to middle ground to background layers of Iron City. And we were very specific. We built Iron City to a height of 24 feet so we could cover all the actors, all the action, and not have to have visual effects, you know, do cutouts around actors for all those close shots. Mm-hmm. And then Weta and visual effects could go in and do their beautiful background paintings that referenced Kowloon, which was a city that Jim Cameron had keyed on many, many years ago as a partial look for Iron City.
Right. What for you was the single sort of most challenging bit of dealing with this film in terms of kind of coming up with a particular production design element?
I think one of the first things, and probably the most challenging part really, is the first step you take, which is breaking down a script. Mm. A script is a series of words. To take that and realize it into a three-dimensional aspect is really a study in abstract thinking. And I think very early on, I remember being at my desk. I have a big work table. It's 4 feet by 8 feet. And I have a big roll of butcher paper. And I would take big swaths of butcher paper the size of my table and start mapping out Iron City. That was done by just going through the script line by line at a time. And that way, it's a way to start blocking out similar moments and start separating out the neighborhoods of Iron City and how you want each neighborhood to differentiate itself architecturally and really give the characters a path through their journey in Iron City. That was quite the mission. And I have, you know, my sheets of maps with diagrams and notations and arrows and things that went all over the place. But after you do that a number of times, the story starts to distill down and you're able to start visualizing block by block. That's what we did, because Iron City was comprised of several different neighborhoods with several different looks and several purposes. So I think we were able to segue and meld those block by block neighborhoods together, just like real cities exist. That was really the thing for us. To me, Iron City became not just a set, but a real living, breathing, organic place. Mm. And that came about because as the crew worked, they put the sweat and the labor in, just like a real city.
Yeah.
They laughed, they had the vitality, and all those things really started to make Iron City breathe. And for that, I'm very proud of our crew, both LA and Austin, because the endeavor was extraordinary.
Yeah, that's incredible, particularly the size of the set is just stunning. You talk about the city and it's got special areas, like there's a warrior arena and a mechanical dump yard and stuff like that. Do you have a particular favorite area of yours?
Oh my gosh, I think there are a number of favorites in both Iron City as well as the interior sets that we built. We also had an entire separate stage facility on which I think we built something like 11 or 13 interior sets.
Right.
And those sets included Dr. Ito's interior clinic, and that was an absolute favorite. Vector's penthouse, another favorite, very severe, total homage to Sir Ken Adam. Those were a couple of the interiors that I also really enjoyed realizing, along with, you know, of course, all of Iron City.
Yeah.
It's all favorite. It's all favorite there.
You're talking about working with Steve, obviously, on this and many other films. How are you sort of dividing up the work? Do you end up with one doing sort of particular areas? Or
that's an interesting question. People often wonder that, because I think jobs are usually structured like in a divided kind of concept. Mm. Steve and I worked together for, I think, 30 years.
Right.
So from the outset, I think the way we work is a very organic process. Nothing is ever necessarily delineated. We just know it. Everything segues together. Weird to say, it's just we're able to work in sync.
Yeah.
He has a background in electrical engineering and mechanical engineering. I have a background in art, photography, painting, study of color. We're able to just bring everything together. We're dialed in a way that I guess it's in the ether. I can't really describe it. But the common thread for us was, you know, we came up through working on set.
Yeah.
So we created our own property department. We built our own prop truck back early in the days and worked on movies of the week. We just like pounded through that kind of grinding practice that makes you absolutely efficient. You learn how to think on your feet, improvise quickly, you know, create something on set at the drop of a hat when it's called for. That kind of training was so valuable. And working on set really taught us the valuable things in production design, which was make sure that the set works for the actors, the director, the DP, and the crew. The set has to actually be able to function so that you can make your shooting day. And we always thought about working from the actors out, because that's where the story is. Know that your props and your set pieces can look vibrant and function and not break and just be robust enough to handle the day. Keep in mind always that core of where the action and the moment and the story is. And I think that's what makes us work together, because we know instinctively what needs to happen. And because we do work together as a team, and I think it really showed in Alita, we're able to create more layers and more depth, more dimension, more depth of field in all the environments than one person alone could.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll come to the last two questions that we ask everybody.
Okay, go.
So the first question is, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
You know, because work has been just so pulverizing lately, I hadn't had a chance to catch up on my Westworld, which I just did in the past 2 weeks. And of course, coming from like the wide open region of the Southwest, I was absolutely riveted by the locations that their locations department was able to find. I don't know how they did it. They must have sent out the drone scouts, because I saw things I've never seen before in those regions.
Wow.
But the diversity of sets and environments, from the most architectural and severe to the West to the Asian environments, that crew was presented with challenges of extraordinary scale. I don't know how they did it. But also just what I'm watching right now, True Detective.
Yeah.
Absolute tone, quiet. But again, that is such a performance-driven piece. And what's it about your characters?
Mm.
And for us on Alita, everything we did was to support the characters. And when you see good television do that, that's where it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last question is, if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, past, present, or future, what show would it be?
Oh my gosh. I just caught up on a little bit of this Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Again, extraordinary very era study art department. It's an era that you love. And of course, Lenny Bruce, the character who plays Lenny Bruce, so riveting.
Yeah.
But the attention to detail in that particular series, I found quite extraordinary. That crew should be really proud.
Yeah, I adore that show. I think it's absolutely fabulous and the work is phenomenal. So
I don't know how they do it.
No.
I mean, I know how they do it. That's the terror.
Yeah, it's incredible. I shall let you get back to your set building or disassembling.
the excitement of paperwork.
Yes,
thank
and
you.
The excitement of paperwork. Yes, it's been lovely to have you on. It'd be great to have you back on at some point in the future when you're working on something else.
Thank you, David, so much.
Speak to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye. Cheers. Bye.
So that was the interview with Kayla Edelblum, production designer on Alita: Battle Angel. You can find Alita: Battle Angel in your nearest cinema right now, so go watch it. Next up, we have some highlights for next week on TV. Highlights for next week on TV. We kick off with Bite Club, which is an Australian series about a group of shark attack survivors who are targeted by a serial killer. Only in Australia would you need a group of, like, a survival group for shark attacks. Although it's Australia, you could have a survival group for any animal that will kill you in Australia, because most
That's
of them
every
will.
Every animal.
Everything wants to kill you in Australia. Dominic Moynihan, he's one of the series stars of that, but that's on Alibi on the 20th of February, and it's called Bite Club. If you want to see the first series, and that is on at 9 p.m. Big Bang Theory returns for the final part of its final season. That's on the 21st of February at 8 p.m. on E4. Flack, which is a show which I think it's very difficult to have avoided because it's been publicity everywhere for this. It's a dramedy set in the fast-paced world of celebrity PR. Stars Anna Paquin. It's an original show for the W Channel in the UK, even though it sounds like it should be an American import. It is actually made in the UK. 21st of February at 10 p.m. for that. That's Flack. Then Curfew, which is this bonkers street race drama that Sky One have commissioned. Stars Sean Bean, Adrian Lester, Phoebe Fox, Malachi Kirby, a whole bunch of other famous names as well. Set in this sort of dystopian future where there is this big street race and they win this sort of huge prize if they manage to win the race, basically. It looks fascinating. I have no idea whether it's any good or not, but 22nd of February at 9 p.m. for that. That's called Curfew and season one of that. The Oscars are also arriving this week. So the 91st Academy Awards, that is going to be previewing from midnight on the 23rd. The actual ceremony starts on the 24th at 1 a.m. if you want to go and watch that live. We've got Alan Partridge returning with This Time with Alan Partridge, which sees Steve Coogan returns to his alter ego. That's the 25th of February at 9:30 on, I think it's actually on BBC One. I've got BBC Two on here. Sees Alan take over on a sort of one show type thing. He's been let back onto TV for the first time in ever. So yes, that if you're a fan of Alan Partridge, is worth watching. Van Helsing returns on the 25th of February onto Netflix for a third season of that show. That is back. Shadowhunters, the second half of the third and final season, although it's not going to be the final season if the fans have any say in it. 26th of February for that. That has a rabid fan base for that. I'm amazed that got cancelled.
Yeah, and you see, as well as that, the Comic-Cons, you see a lot of people cosplaying as those characters. So it definitely has, as you say, like a lot of interest from the fans. So I'm wondering how they're not getting the viewing figures.
It's crazy. I honestly don't know, because the people that love it really, really love Shadowhunters. And I have to say, I haven't watched it. I know that's probably awful to admit to some people, but I don't understand. I don't understand how it's not got the numbers and why somebody else hasn't swooped in on it. It's 26th of February on Netflix for the second half of its third and final, at the moment, of season of Shadowhunters. And then we have The Miracle coming to Sky Atlantic, which a drama set during an operation at a mob boss's hideout where police find a sculpture of the Virgin Mary, which appears to be weeping blood. It's from Sky Italia, the people that made Gomorrah. It's coming to Sky Atlantic. That's the 26th of February at 9 p.m. for that. And that's everything for this week, unless you've got anything else you'd like to add in.
I think we packed quite a lot into there.
Yeah, I think so. So if people want to find you, where can they find you?
They can find me as Trystabytes, spelled B-Y-T-E-S, because I thought it would be fun to make a geeky pun out of my name and make spelling it difficult. But I can be found on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and very soon again on Twitch once I've sticky taped aforementioned cables back together again. And also sometimes I put articles and videos up on the Geektown website as well.
Yes, for us, you can find us obviously at geektown.co.uk throughout the week and find all the latest airdate info. If you want to get in touch with your questions and comments, email us on podcast@geektown.co.uk. Leave a message on the website post. Find us at Geektown on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/geektown, and on Instagram @geektownuk. That is everything. We shall see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.